unaware that his client was temporarily distracted by the thought of a destitute lady living in the effing forest, bereft of her boys, her pride and joy, Thunderbolt continued, "Take Mr. Simnel's pressure gauge. Once the principle is proved and understood, the cunning artificers, extremely cunning as they are, might well find some way of achieving the same results without breaching patent. It's what they do. Cunning by name and nature."
Thunderbolt had got Harry's attention now.
"And before you explode, Sir Harry, it is all within the law." "What? After all I've done and the money I've put in?"
Harry's face was as red as a beacon. He looked as though he needed one of Dick's pressure gauges himself. Moist decided to intervene. "Harry, the whole point of trains is that they're universal. Put them on the tracks and away they go." In his mellifluous tones, the lawyer continued,
"If I were you, Sir Harry, I would simply leave it to me to keep an eye on such things as patents and licenses and regulation, whilst you and Mr. Simnel filled the world with steam. And remember, Sir Harry, the important thing is that you were the first. Nobody can take that away. You, Sir Harry, are on what I believe is called the hog's back, the top of the heap, the founder of the railway. The Ankh-Morpork and Stow Plains Hygienic Railway Company is as solid as the bank."
The troll smiled and said,
"Or indeed, as me. And I am Diamond."
Business for the Hygienic Railway Company was indeed booming, and the workforce ever expanding. The goblins from the Quirmian Maquis had passed news back to their friends about the opportunities in the big Wahoonee, which they seized with alacrity. And once Dick's announcement of his railway academy had been splashed across the papers, in the wake of the Effing Forest incident, there were queues of people every day wanting to be taken on as apprentices. Simnel was heavy on the lads he accepted, telling them they had got to let the iron enter their soul, and it was not unknown for him to kick someone straight out again if he felt they weren't up to scratch. Returning from another trip to review progress on the Quirm line, Moist paused to take in the latest changes to the compound. There were the apprentices, engrossed in their own little mechanical world, with Wally and Dave tutoring them and making sure they had got their caps sufficiently flat. Moist watched them in their blissful mechanical dream, and he could not help but notice that they were surrounded by goblins, most definitely paying attention, seriously so, as if their lives depended upon it, and gathering up any discarded greasy rags, which to goblins were like haute couture, and a mark of a real swell back in the burrows. And nearby the train spotters were comparing numbers, and there was Mr. Simnel, equally engrossed in his latest contraption. As Moist crossed the compound towards him, Mr. Simnel, with his greasy hat and his grubby shirt, the sleeves of which were rolled up to his elbows, wiped his grinning face with a rag, leaving a greasy smear on the grease.
"Mr. Litwig, grand to see you. I've something to show you. We brought this beauty down from Stall at yesterday and built it last night."
He was shouting even louder than normal.
"Essential equipment. It's my design. I built it, and I call it Turning Table."
Moist almost had to put his hands over his ears as the engineer stepped closer. "It's because he works with the trains all day," he thought. "He has to be heard among all the hissing and clanking, but I wonder how he talks to his Emily." As for the turning table, it was, well, it was a table, and it turned. A huge metal table with a pair of rails running across the centre, which was turned around by means of a large handle attached to a ratchet mechanism being wound by a troll, with a look of intense concentration. Moist watched while Dick gave his demonstration.
"Great! That's brilliant, Dick, but for the sake of the hard of thinking, what in hell's name is it for?"
Dick looked at Moist as if he was an infant and said,
"Can't you see it, Mr. Litwig? You drives your engine onto turning table, and here's the clever bit, you turn the whole thing round, and it's now facing t'other way."
And then Mr. Simnel danced on the circular iron table in his clogs as it slowly revolved and shouted,
"Grand! Gradely! We're nearly there!"
The triumph was emphasised with a hiss like iron girder at the end of a long run, which would have been a fitting end to the experiment, except that it took some time to get the troll to stop turning the handle so that Dick, who was starting to look a little green from the continued revolutions, could get off. Happy that the tussle of wills between the other companies operating on the stow planes was being ably managed by Thunderbolt and Drumknot, no doubt with assistance from the Dark Clerks, Boyst was looking forward to a period of domestic harmony when he was summoned to the palace. He was not surprised to see his lordship staring at the day's crossword puzzle. Drumknot whispered from behind Moist, "There's a new compiler, you know, and I'm sad to say that it looks like an improvement. However, his lordship is doing his best." Lord Vetinari looked up and said, "Mr. Lipvig, can it be that there is a word, quistury?" Actually, Moist knew exactly what it meant because of his misspent youth, and so he girded his metaphorical loins and said, "I think you might find, sir, that it means someone doing business simply for profit. I remember coming across the word once upon a time, and it puzzled me because I thought profit was what business is all about." His lordship's face didn't move a muscle until he said, "Quite so, Mr. Lipvig," and he pushed the paper aside and stood up. "I hear that the line to Querm is all but completed. If the Querm Assembly is still dragging its feet, I shall have to have a word with Monsieur Jean Neymar, one of my special words. I have to say, Mr. Lipvig, that your contribution to the development of the railway has been most gratifying to observe, and I am sure we are all in your debt." "Oh," said Moist, "does that mean I can get back to my day job and see my wife more than once every week or so?" "Of course you may, Mr. Lipvig. You have, after all, been acting in an entirely voluntary capacity. However, my business now concerns the railway to Oberwald. So I have to ask you, how soon can we have a locomotive run all the way there, non-stop?" Moist was taken aback. "You couldn't do it, sir, not non-stop. You have to take on water and coal, and it must be more than 1,000 miles up there." 1,225 miles exactly from Ankh-Morpork to Bionk by coach, although I'm aware that the train would have to take a different route." "Yes, sir, but a non-stop—" "Mr. Lipvig, if you're going to tell me that it's impossible, you will be down with the kittens in short order. After all, you are the man who gets things done." "What's the hurry, sir? The lads are doing a great job, but it would be a rare day if they could lay more than 3 miles of track, even with all the money Harry King is throwing at it. And then, of course, there's all the unforeseen obstacles along the way, and on top of that you know that every city along the plains wants to be a part of the network. We're spread wide, sir. Any further and we'd split down the middle." Vetinari walked around his desk at speed and said, "Good. Then you could both work more efficiently." "It appears, Mr. Lipvig, that you do not understand the nature of our relationship. I ask, very politely, for you to achieve something, bearing in mind that there are other ways I could ask, and it is your job to get things done. You are, after all, a man who can apparently do anything. The great Mr. Lipvig, yes. And my advice to you is to cease all the work that does not assist in getting from here to Oberwald in the quickest possible time. Everything else can, and will, wait." He held up his hand. "Do not tell me what the problems are. Just tell me the solutions. Indeed, you do not need to tell me the solutions. You merely have to achieve them." Moist said, "Do you mind if I sit down, sir?" "By all means, Mr. Lipvig. Do get the man a drink, Drumknot. He looks a little hot." "I have to ask, sir, why does it have to be done like this?" Vetinari smiled. "Can you keep a secret, Mr. Lipvig?" "Oh, yes, sir, I've kept lots." "Capital. And the point is, so can I. You do not need to know." Moist tried. "Sir, even now, the trains are part of life to a lot of people, especially those on the plains who commute. We can't just drop everything, sir." "Mr. Lipvig, is there something in the word tyrant you do not understand?" In desperation, Moist said, "We don't have enough workers, sir. Not enough people to man the foundries. Not enough people to dig the ore. We've probably got enough stock now to get halfway, but it's all about the workers." "Yes," said Lord Vetinari, "it is, isn't it? Think on that, Mr. Lipvig. What about the wizards? Can't they get up off their fat backsides and help their city?"
Yes, Mr. Litvig, and you know and I know it will rebound on us. Live steam is friendly compared with magic going wrong. No, Mr. Litvig, we will not look to the wizards. You just need to get the train to run to Uberwald on time. And what time would that be, sir?
As I say, Mr. Litvig, any time soon.
Then I haven't got a prayer. It's going to take months, a year or more. And suddenly the atmosphere turned to ice. And his lordship said, Then I suggest you get going.
Vetinari resumed his seat. Mr. Litvig, the world lives between those who say it cannot be done and those who say that it can. And in my experience, those who say that it can be done are usually telling the truth. It's just a matter of thinking creatively. Some people say, think the unthinkable, but that's nonsense. Although in your case, sir, I think you have the nerves for it. Think about it. Now, don't let me detain you.
The door closed behind Moist, and silence enveloped the oblong office, as the patrician returned his attention to the crossword. Eventually, he frowned, filled in a line, and laid down the paper. Drumknot, he said. How's Charlie's Punch and Judy business going these days? Is he doing well? I wonder whether he might consider a short holiday. Just a short one, that is.
Yes, sir, said Drumknot. I'll go and see him this afternoon.
That's the way to do it, said Lord Vetinari. While he was still reeling from the patrician's latest demand, Moist found himself riding back to the Effing Forest on a mission for Harry.
"Go and see the old girl and send her my sympathies," Harry had said. "Tell her I was impressed at how her boys tried to harness steam, and I salute them as pioneers. Have a look around and see what she's got, and since it would seem as if I have got gold coming out of my ears, then I reckon we can give her a little pension. Though for heaven's sake, don't let anyone else know. Oh, and tell her that I'll make it certain that her lads will be up front line when the history of the railway is written down, and say she can call on me at any time."
The old homestead in the forest was all that Moist had expected, and Mrs. Wesley burst into tears when he told her about Harry's offer. She was determined to think of Sir Harry as a saint or angel, and if Moist knew anything about the ways of the world, Harry's gesture would be all over the forest within hours. And because news spreads, it would get as far as Ankh-Morpork by the end of the day. Moist knew Harry the man as he was, extremely sharp with a heart of gold and tears of soppy. Harry's gesture was entirely Harry, with no ulterior motive, but nevertheless, once the news had got around, he would be in all the papers as a benefactor of the poor and therefore a celebrity. Not for the first time, Moist deplored his own tendency to see the angles in whatever happened, good or bad.
"How much?"
The simple question sounded like a declaration of war, which it almost was, as Harry was presented with the costings for the express line to Bionk. Moist stood his ground. "Dick says there's iron everywhere, Harry, but it needs digging out, and then it's the making of the steel that uses up the money," he put in hastily, before Harry could throw anyone down the stairs.
"You've got to put the gold in to get steel out, Harry," said Simnel calmly. "We've been getting a good deal from the lads down at the smelters, but it's 1,200 miles to Uberwald, and that's a lot of steel."
"Harry," Moist said patiently, "I know very well that when you and your lady first married, you used to cut the matches in half to make them last longer, but you are not that man any more. You can afford this." They watched Harry's face. In truth, Moist knew Harry had kicked his way up from the gutter and was proud of it. But he had made his money cheaply, since minions, on the whole, don't incur much of an overhead, and looked at every suggestion that he should pay for anything as evidence that something was wrong in the world. Dick Simnel had got the measure of the man and said, "If I was you, sir, I'd look at my money box and buy as much steel as I possibly could while I can, not making a big fuss about it, otherwise it'll suddenly get more expensive, if you know what I mean. Supply and demand." Harry still looked as if he thought people were trying to get something of a move on him, which was his grand state of being, and Moist thought, "Well, what does Harry spend his mountains of money on?" And so he plunged on. "Go on, Harry. As a customer in good standing, the Royal Bank'll definitely give you a loan,
if indeed you ever need one, though frankly I know your balance is more than enough to get the rails all the way to the moon and back, and that's including a fleet of locomotives as well." There was a rumble from Mr. Thunderbolt. "Of course, Sir Harry, you could sell shares. That means you share some of the outlays, but alas, you also have to share some of the dividends. It's up to you." Moist saw his cue right there and said, "You see, Harry, everybody who buys your railway shares would then be dead keen on their railway and on your side. It's what the trolls call a no-brain. When the smoke is making you rich, it's your smoke, and you don't complain about it. And," Moyse took a deep breath, "if you share the risks, you can afford to build houses for the railway workers too. That way they'll live close to the railway, right alongside it, so they'll always be ready."
"I don't need any telling on that score, Mr. Litvig. The lads that work for me on the conveyor belts all live on the doorstep. Difference is they built their own."
"The buildings don't have to be little palaces," Moist said. "Just comfortable, with a bit of a garden, which is nice for the kiddies. And then everyone is happy and you've got it made. After all, who doesn't like to have a place close to their work? Nice and warm, with all the coal you need thrown in." Harry King would probably punch anyone who called him a philanthropist, but beneath the grumbling there was an undercurrent of curious softness. Elderly employees, no matter their species, ended up with a pension, a rare beast in Ankh Morpork as a whole, and Moist, as Harry's bank manager, was aware that expensive hospital bills had a habit of disappearing when he got to hear about them. And most certainly at Hogswatch, Harry, grumbling like an elderly troll with a headache, nevertheless made sure all employees had actual named meat on their tables, and lots of it. And yet Harry was still a Titan, a humorous term meaning deep trousers and short fingers, owing to his tendency to look on the disgorging of money in much the same light as root canal surgery delivered by a troll dentist. Moist, who knew his man, continued, "Look at it like this. I know that as a self-made man, sharing would be anathema to your soul. So you could take all the risk and become as rich as creosote. However, it seems to me, Harry, that you're already as rich as creosote. And so, as a scoundrel, I'd suggest that another fortune is not exactly what you need right now. As your bank manager, I'd like to suggest that sharing both the risks and the profits would be the most prudent and socially acceptable way." For a moment, Moist saw the psyche of Harry King putting together a retort that social acceptability could go and get its hands dirty by doing a proper day's work, rather than interfering with honest entrepreneurs who are working their guts out day and night. But Moist also saw the grin and realised that Harry knew this was all part of the solution. After all, Lord Veterinary liked the people of Ankh Morpork to feel they had a stake in their city. "Anyway," he said, to clinch it, "Veterinary wants the Überwald route and he's the ultimate boss. Who knows? The city might be very generous with its level of funding. The trains go round and round, and so does the money." The main line to Querm was completed with a ceremony at the Ankh Morpork terminus, in which, regrettably, alcohol played a major role. The new engine was launched and named Fierté de Querm, with an especially good bottle of champagne smashed across its boiler by the Marquis des Aix-en-Pins, and his wife, who Moist noticed was now very cheerfully, as they say in Querm, enceinte. And amid all the celebrations, it seemed that it was only Moist who noticed that Simnel had wandered away from the party to wipe the engine clean of sizzling champagne with his handkerchief, which immediately became a greasy rag. He gave Moist a severe look. "We can't have this kind of thing going on, Mr. Litvig, interfering with the engine. Not when I'm determined to get us up to 40 miles per hour across the flat of the Mackie, just to show those lobsters what we can do." On the maiden journey, Moist rode with Simnel and the stoker on the footplate as the Mackie passed away behind them at terrible speed, with goblins waving from every rock and ancient tree. He thought, at one point, that he had spotted Of the Twilight the Darkness waving, but to his surprise found the egregious goblin waiting when they pulled into the Querm city terminus. It seemed to Moist that the little bastard had channels through the world that weren't available to humans. In the carriages behind, a good time was had by all, with avec galore and lashings of the famous Entente Cordiale. The smart new passenger carriages were much admired.
A highlight for many was the dapper gentleman looking after the first-class gentleman's facilities, who was adept at handling towels and explaining the workings of the glass cistern, which contained goldfish that appeared to revel in the rush of the flush, but were, in fact, kept from going with the flow by a concealed sieve of some kind. There was a big parade to greet them at Querm Central, heralding another round of civic and political razzmatazz, all punctuated with more alcohol and ending with a huge dinner in the engine shed. And there were yet more toasts before the locomotive was turned around on the new-fangled turning table to take the Ankh-Morpork contingent home, where they had to be decanted from the train. And so it was that one fine summer evening shortly afterwards, Moist and Adora Bell sat down to an excellent dinner of fresh lobsters from Querm, brought up on the new three-day mare express. They were good and cheaper now than he ever remembered, and the dish went very well with the watercress, which burned all the way down as they ate it. And afterwards there were fresh strawberries and a soft bed with fluffy pillows, and somehow it made all the running around worthwhile. It began in Higher Overhang in the Shires. People locally were saying they could hear noises in the night, metallic noises, clanking, and the occasional scream of metal straining in torment. Of course, everybody said, well, goblins, what can you expect? And all this came to the notice of Chief Constable Feeney Upshot, attached to the Ankh-Morpork Constabulary. Feeney liked the attachment. It meant that anyone getting stroppy with him would sooner or later have to deal with Commander Vimes or even Sergeant Detritus, whose appearance in this sleepy hinterland had caused such a big stir a couple of years before. So Feeney got on his horse and headed to the Overhangs, so called because in the flaming distant past the landscape had been twisted all over the place with unfathomable caverns and a jagged, unforgiving terrain. Feeney was a decent and sensible copper, and such men made friends because they never knew when they would need one, especially when they were a copper all alone, although in theory Feeney had the support of Special Constable of the Chimney the Bones. There had to be a law, and law applied to everyone, and now the law had decreed that goblins were people, and therefore protected by the law in these parts, which, in fact, was made incarnate in Chief Constable Feeney and his constable. Amazingly, the constable allowed his superior officer to call him Boney, on the sensible basis that if there was some melee or other and you needed help, you'd want a simple word to scream. Feeney was privileged. To a goblin, the name is always the name, untouchable and part of the goblin itself. Feeney had been to Ankh-Morpork and was proud to have undertaken his basic training in Pseudopolis Yard under Sergeant Detritus. He recognised that Boney was slightly more intelligent than the notorious Corporal Nobby Nobbs, and so he didn't grumble. And now he was glad to see his constable waiting for him just outside the main goblin cave where he had an office, regarded by the local goblins as something of a shrine. These days there was a flourishing colony of goblins in Overhang Minor. The goblins were purveyors of fine pots, and Feeney knew that the production of pots was generally a quiet pastime and didn't involve very much banging. The small cave that passed as an office was, and you have to be careful about this sort of thing, definitely not manned, but goblined. And the sound coming from the great cavern beyond it was not about pots, that was certain. It was metallic. Heavy metal. Well, and Feeney stumbled here, slightly, mentally at least. Goblins were free, and if people wanted to bang metal around in the privacy of their great caverns, then they could. He blinked. It was the new world. If you didn't get your head around it, it could turn you upside down. Feeney was polite, and had been smart enough to pick up some of the goblin lingo, which really helped. It was a sunny day, and it was an easy trip to the Overhangs. And yes, on the hill above the cavern there was a clax station goblined by goblins. After delivering his papers and force orders, Feeney sat down for a quiet word with his fellow officer, and broached, in a careful way, the subject of goblins banging things around in a context of disturbing the peace. Since there were very few humans living anywhere near the goblins' settlement, Chief Constable Feeney put the complaints down to the humans' residual dislike of goblins doing anything whatsoever anywhere. But he did advise that maybe moving whatever it was they were doing further into their caves might be a very good idea.
The crackling voice of Boney said, "No worries, boss, hang. We are copacetic on this one. No problems here."
"Well, that's good to know, but why all the banging and clanging, Boney?"
"Chief, you know goblins go to Ankh-Morpork and work for Sir Harry King, the shit magnet, on the railway. Know how it is, yes? Comes back every month with wages. Never had wages before. Sometime they comes with diagrams and ideas and scheming attics."
Boney watched his superior officer with a certain level of concern and heard Feeney say, "They are stealing ideas." There was silence, and Feeney knew he had made a faux pas, but Boney laughed and said,
"No, sir, improving. We like Sir Harry, very good employer, but we plan to build own goblin railway. Quick to get around and easy, no problem. Has found best way to build railway is not build. Digging. Dig underground. Underground goblin-sized railway, yes? We'll bring all goblins together from every caverns. So many caverns in bowels of world. It's no fuss. Goblins needed all over. How would nice Miss Adorable Dearheart do if no goblins on clacks? We can be trusted. Well, as much as we trust you stinking humans. Wonderful railways underground. Narrow gauge, of course, you see. We even have lingo. No rain and no snow. No bothering donkeys. No frightening old ladies underground. Hang. At least goblins own world in tunnels under big man human world. We goblins up in the light now. No turning back."
Feeney thought about this on the ride home as his horse trotted gently towards the sunset. He wasn't a philosopher and couldn't even spell the word, but the voice of the goblin officer rang in his head. He thought, what would happen if goblins learned everything about humans and did everything the human way because they thought it was better than the goblin way? How long would it be before they were no longer goblins and left behind everything that was goblin, even their pots? The pots were lovely. He'd bought several for his mum. Goblins took pots seriously now. They sparkled, even at night, but what happens next? Will goblins really stop taking an interest in their pots? And will humans learn the serious, valuable, and difficult and almost magical skill of pot-making? Or will goblins become, well, just another kind of human? And which would be better? And then he thought, maybe a policeman should stop thinking about all this because, after all, there was no crime, nothing was wrong. And yet, in a subtle way, there was. Something was being stolen from the world without anybody noticing or caring. And then he gave up, because he was nearly home, and his mum had promised him man-dog-suck-po with mashed carrots, and it wasn't even a Sunday. Building the longest railway the world had yet seen was a matter of daily grind, and nightly grind too, and each week took Moist further away from the city. Visits home to enjoy the fruits of his labour, or indeed the fruit de mer of his labour, became even rarer. Scattered along the 1,000-mile route, new railway yards were springing up, each one a constant hive of activity, with wagons coming and going all hours of the day and night. And while the company made sure the workforce was well provisioned, since, as Harry King had told the Ankh-Morpork Times, railway workers seriously needed a good meal and a good sleep in a comfortable bed after a day of heavy labour, in the end, whether or not the bed was warm or comfortable didn't in fact really matter, because a lad would sleep the moment he fell into it, just as soon as the former occupant, waving his billy can, had hurried off for his shift. It was all about speed and occasionally pure machismo, or whatever it was called in the languages of trolls, goblins and golems, and of course, the real hardcore steel men from the mountains who fought amongst themselves over nothing. Where the new line followed the course of the River Ankh as it narrowed towards its source high in the ramtops, barges came up or down the river with wood for sleepers, iron ore, coal and other supplies. The smelters worked through the night casting rails, and if you were lucky enough to be in the right place and sufficiently protected, you could see them open their guts and spill the glowing liquid steel, dancing and living like a creature from the underworld. If you were not lucky and stood too close, then quite probably you would end up in that underworld facing the deity of your choice. And all was fueled by money, 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 eager investors turning gold into steel and coal in the hope that it would turn back into even more gold.